Maj Touré of Black Guns Matter, the interview on This Uprising, plus Ilhan Omar and a mini micro Biden report. Stay tuned and see.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. Watch it.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Welcome back to The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Thank you for listening. And, Ilhan Omar maybe eclipsing AOC now as the sort of lightning rod for attention on the progressive side of things and criticism for that side from the right. Donald Trump gave a masterful trolls performance as he was getting out of town and discussing the stories that she married her brother in order to basically get him into the country to avoid some immigration issues and maybe benefit from some tax fraud as well. Well, the best non-denial denial. Tim likes to say you never deny the charge with specificity when it's made. You don't say, I did not embezzle money. You say, I've comported myself with honor and haven't broken the law. So that they can't replay the charge. Anyway, this is Trump without making a charge that he has any evidence or information to sustain. Of course, he very likely doesn't. But in any case, he wants to respond to this question thrown at him by a reporter.
Is your administration going to possibly look into immigration fraud committed by Ilhan Omar by possibly marrying her brother? Tax fraud?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the fact that she was married to a brother. I know nothing about it. I hear she was married to a brother. You're asking me a question about it. I don't know, but I'm sure that somebody would be looking at that.
I'm sure there would be somebody who would be looking at that. Well, she's asking if he has directed anybody, and it's his administration to look at it, but it's so great. The fact, well, I've heard it reported about the fact that she was married to her brother. That's right. What a perfect way to say it, Donald. Well, the thing about Ilhan Omar, whether she was married to her brother or not, I mean, whatever. If she didn't pay enough federal income tax, okay, whatever. There was a story about Ilhan Omar, though, that I think really cuts to the quick about her and her opinion of America and what I think is profoundly disturbing about her, and really should give us pause before elevating her to any kind of leadership. Obviously, the people of the whatever district of Minneapolis or whoever, Senator Congress, can have her as their congressperson. But Democrats, progressives, anybody who actually doesn't want to see the country broken up for real, I think you want to look at this story. And it comes from a Washington Post profile of the good congresswoman, published earlier in July. And it talks about how she was in a speech before 400 students in Richfield High School in Minneapolis, and how she chooses to use her time, how Congressman Omar addresses the youth of America is to remind them, to take her time to remind them that it is not a place that lives up to its ideals. That's her primary goal. Her primary thing is to say that racially, it's a horrible place, and it treats people who are typically women and dark like slaves or also ran or property or something like that. That's the focus of the thing. Let's turn our attention to the Washington Post. In Omar's version, America wasn't the big-hearted country that saved her from a brutal war and a bleak refugee camp. It wasn't a meritocracy that helped her attend college or vaulted her into Congress. Instead, it was the country that had failed to live up to its founding ideals, a place that had disappointed her and so many immigrants, refugees, and minorities like her. I grew up, quote, I grew up in an extremely unjust society, and the only thing that made my family excited about coming to the United States was that the United States was supposed to be the country that guaranteed justice to all, she told the high school students. So I feel it necessary for me to speak about that promise that's not kept. Oh, really? So the only thing from a refugee camp in Somalia that got her excited about coming to the United States was that it guaranteed justice to all? That's a bit ephemeral for a Somali refugee camp dweller, isn't it? Is it possible that the notion of clean and abundant food and water and comfortable living standards was part of the appeal? No. Okay, just the justice part. And that's where, of course, we're failing. Now, here's the story that she graces the 400 students with to demonstrate that we're failing. So she tells the students a story about when she was working for a Minneapolis city councilman in 2014. She tells him that he wanted her to report on problems with the courts. And so she went to investigate on behalf of this Minneapolis councilman, and she recalled a sweet old African-American lady, these are quotes, who had been arrested for stealing a $2 loaf of bread to feed to her starving 5-year-old granddaughter. After spending the weekend in jail, the woman was led into the courtroom and fined $80, a penalty she couldn't pay. Quote, I couldn't control my emotions, Omar continues, because I couldn't understand how a room full of educated adults could do something so unjust. Bullshit, she recalls yelling in the courtroom. And then the Washington Post writer lets us know that laughter rippled through the auditorium and then silence. Now, the only problem with this is, unlike some crazy Soviet Union propaganda booklet that may be passed around a Somali refugee camp, we don't lock up sweet old black ladies in America for stealing $2 loaves of bread to feed their starving granddaughters. Doesn't happen. That this is something that she... It's like some crazy anti-Semitic trope they used to sell that Jews have horns in some Palestinian neighborhood where they're still 100 years away from the internet. This kind of idea that people can starve to death in America in any case. The problem with our poor is an excess of calories, not a deficiency, and we don't lock people up for that in the United States. Well, fortunately, in an uncharacteristic fashion, the Washington Post put some skepticism on the story and mentions that it happens to also be the plot of Les Miserables, where the person is locked up for 5 years for, guess what, stealing a crust for their siblings or something like that. So if true, it is also probably embellished, is what the report says. City officials say the police aren't allowed to arrest people for shoplifting and then unless there's a likelihood of violence or further crime. Do you think that might be especially true if the shoplifting is by a grandmother and it's a loaf of bread for a starving toddler? And then typically shoplifters are sentenced to attend a 3-hour class. In an interview, Omar said she may have flubbed some facts. Quote, she might have had a prior arrest, Omar said. I'm not sure. The details might not all have matched, but that's what I remember. Indeed, that's what she remembers. She remembers the part that didn't happen, which was that that jurisprudence in America allowed this black woman, an elderly, sweet old lady grandma, who was trying to steal to feed a starving toddler, to be locked up. And that is the lie that she chooses to talk about what America means to her, to the assembled students. And it's not true. America has so many blemishes on her that if you want to expose a massive shortcoming that her politicians, by the way, have gotten her into. Because let's be clear, it's not the people that are doing these damaging things by and large. It's the politicians. The people didn't want Jim Crow, okay? The people of the South, after the Civil War, could not be counted on to be sufficiently racist against their black neighbors that the racist people of the South, who wanted to make sure they were racists, made them do so under color of law. It was illegal for them to treat black people as equals because they were afraid they would. That's where we are without government, without politicians like you, Ilhan Omar, who chooses to lie about America. You're so poisoned on America, and by the way, so freaking ignorant that you can't even point out some of the real things that Americans have done that are grossly off-putting, anti-liberty, and disgusting. Instead, you have to make it up. You know, I think that I can forgive a politician maybe if it was an Ilhan Omar and it was some kind of an election bid, and she talked about how, you know, she saw the Statue of Liberty's torch as it rose above the horizon as the boat reached our shore. You know, something powerful and whatever. Like, okay, fine, you're telling a narrative. I get that sort of white lie. But here's a lie in service to denigrate the country that she wishes to serve. I mean, I don't know. It just seems more and more like, forget about the brother and the taxes and the whatever. There's a bigger problem there. There's an insufficient supply of racist, sexist laws and cops and whatever out there for Omar. So she has to make them up in order to demonstrate what a hero she is to these students. Well, that's the kind of lie I can't abide. It's one thing to call a spade or talk about and expose inconvenient truths. But to make up a lie, a false lie, a damnable lie, you congresswoman, just to make America look bad and yourself look better in the eyes of these high school students from your district? Well, if the orange man wasn't so bad, I suggest some of these legacy media types would be covering that story and just how scandalous it is. But we don't live in that world because Ilhan Omar is saying the right things. She is a woman of color and she has the correct opinions for a woman of color. The thing that would be dangerous, the thing that we can't abide, is if she had incorrect opinions from a woman of color. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm referring to Ayanna Pressley, who is a congresswoman from Chicago. And she actually, at the Netroots conference in Philadelphia, basically, in no uncertain terms, and you're going to hear it for your own ears, but what she's saying is, if you're a gay man, you better come to the table as a candidate for office representing gay men, whatever that means. If you are a black woman, then that's who you're supposed to represent. What it means is that there are certain positions that you must take because of the immutable characteristics that you have, your race, your sex, all these things. It's the literal and metaphysical opposite of everything that anti-racists have worked for until this time, which is to say that people should be treated and judged individually, not on the basis of the color of their skin or their who they want to have sex with. It's something else entirely. Not Ariana Pressley. Oh, no.
And for all of you that have aspirations of running for office, for whatever lived experience and identity that you represent, if you are not prepared to come to that table and to represent that voice, don't come. Because we don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice. We don't need black faces that don't want to be a black voice. We don't need Muslims that don't want to be a Muslim voice. We don't need queers that don't want to be a queer voice. Come on, speak it. And if you're worried about being marginalized and stereotyped, please don't even show up. Because we need you to represent that.
If you're worrying about being marginalized or stereotyped, don't even show up. Well, she's already done it. She's all the marginalization and stereotypation, what's that? Well, I'm not going to go it again. it's complete. It's a fait accompli. You're already marginalized. You can't, we don't need to know what your position on an issue is. What's your position on an issue? Well, what's the official black position as determined by who? Somebody at the New York Times? Well, that's what your official position is. What's the official gay position? If Pete Buttigieg just wants to be president of the United States and demonstrate his research and policymaking effectiveness and politicking, being a good politician, that's not acceptable. He has to represent gays. Otherwise, he's not doing his job. Otherwise, stay home. That's the message from these progressives. Well, guess what? And here's the problem. That's what happens with whites, too. If you want to go ahead and turn the page, which is that whites will now have to come to the table, and guess who they'll have to represent? Not good policy, not the best for the gander, but oh no, now let's divide and conquer on racial lines and racial spoils. Only, instead of saying, okay, white people are guilty, you can have whatever you want, at some point they're going to turn the tables and say, you know what, no, stop. Now we're going to start taking. It's just going to be a natural fact. That's the natural result of this. So this identity politics leads one place only, and it's concentration camps. Well, it's not all bad news. Keep hope alive. There are voices out there, compelling voices, that are rejecting that identity politics. And we're fortunate enough that I had an interview with one of those voices this week. Maj Touré is the founder of Black Guns Matter. He is the antithesis of these progressives who tell black people that they have to vote Democrat and think a certain way because of the color of their skin. And Maj is out there basically encouraging them and urging them to celebrate their individual rights. And so for that, we salute him. And hopefully you'll find the following chat enjoyable and you can learn about what Black Guns Matter is. Unfortunately, we couldn't have Maj in studio, and so the audio is a little bit more of a challenge than our usual production, but I hope it's worth it, and you enjoy it. Maj Touré is the co-founder of Black Guns Matter. He's also a candidate for city council, an at-large seat in Philadelphia, and I've heard about him from multiple different angles, from Philly, from guns, also from Misesian libertarians, where he's also involved in that movement as well. He is on the libertarian ticket for the city council. So thank you for doing good work and being a guest on The Uprising, Maj.
Thank you for having me, man.
You're welcome. So the question is, you're a black guy, you're from the hood, you're a libertarian, and a gun rights activist. That is an uncommon position to be in. So the question is, how did you get in that position?
Yeah, I got to that position pretty much from being practical and simple. I'm generally a very simple dude. And so what happens is, it's one of the things that, you know, that's one of the things that people like about me, but it can be annoying because of my simplicity. And I was kind of telling a story about how one time our coffee pot broke at HQ, and I mean, we had filters and we had coffee, so I just pulled out a pot and I used a rubber band and like dumped coffee in the filter and then dumped the coffee filter in the pot and just boiled it. And so my partner was like, yeah, you like a cowboy, so it's like cowboy coffee, like,
right.
Right. This very, very simple and pragmatic approach to just life in general. And so how I'm able to translate in all of these different rooms is because I try to break things all the way down to a very simple parable or a story or an example that the general public can relate to. And so even in areas where people have different ideologies than me, I can say, well, let me tell you why I view this particular way. So when you have all of those different backgrounds of people, like you're saying, you're talking about ANCAP people, you're talking about hood people, you're talking about pro-gun people from these different walks of life in different parts of the country, the thing that they're all relating to about me is the simplicity and just basic truth. Truth resonates. So that's how I've been able to get to that point of a lot of people identify with it. And I hear it all of the time. People will say, well, I follow you on social media, and I don't agree with everything what you say, but I like how you say it. I like how you break it down. I can follow the logic of it, you know. And so I think that's a very important characteristic to have. when you're dealing with the general public and trying to move an entire culture forward of freedom or liberty with people that have these varying differences and understandings or differentiating degrees of where they are in their particular life. So everybody can understand things from a very simple and practical approach, and that's just how I am as a person, and I've pretty much always been that way.
Is your candidacy for office an outgrowth of your gun rights activism, or is it the other way around, or are they completely separate?
Well, I wouldn't even say it's separate. I think that, or growing out of, I think they were kind of mutual. So when you start dealing with the Second Amendment, you're automatically involved in some politics, whether you're aware of it or not.
Right.
And so, you know, in doing that, you start...
Especially if you're in a city like Philadelphia, which has a troubled history when it comes to recognizing people's Second Amendment rights.
Exactly. And so because of that, you start to think, you know, okay, I'm traveling around the country. We're doing these classes. You know what I'm saying? We involving ourselves in all of these different things. And we go to these, you know, these state capitals all around the country. And you hear all of these people saying these things. But then at the same time, there's a fervor there. There's people, you know, the rank and file, the general public, we the people, want this particular freedom. And then all it takes is one jerk politician to ignore his or her constituency and write a different thing into effect. So the next thing is, okay, but how can we block it on that end? The people want this, but the people may not necessarily be as politically active as we would like them to be right now. Okay, now you go over here and you try to voice that perspective within a public perspective seat. You know what I mean? And so it's basically they go hand in hand, like firearms and freedom.
When you go out campaigning to any Philadelphian who has the capacity to vote for you, do you go out and sell gun rights first, or do you have you sell a libertarian vision for the city? How do you approach it?
I don't do either. I just listen to them and let them tell me what their issues and concerns are, and then just try to find a solution for that. A public servant is literally that, as a servant, a person that serves and practices a service of assistance and helping. And so whether that's a gun problem, whether that's an emotional, a traumatic problem from ignorance, whether that's a political lack of understanding problem, you got to recognize what their issue is first. So I don't even really, you know, try to sell them on anything. I just try to have conversation and be open to hearing them, you know. And then after hearing them, you know, if I have something I can present as a particular solution to their issue, we come up with that solution and we apply it. That develops a certain level of trust. That trust creates a space where this person wants to go, okay, I like this dude. He's done his job. He's served my needs very well. I think I want to learn more or support this guy in the work he's doing. That's it. And then they'll ask questions. Well, what do you think about this? And I'll go, well, this is what I think about that. This is what I think about this right here. This is what I think about that right here. You know, and then it'll start small and it usually bubbles up into something bigger, you know. And really, I just give the space for the person to be who they are. And when they are who they are, I can still be who I am. And at the same time, we can find a common ground. But when you educate them after they feel comfortable with you, you educate them about their natural rights to defend their life. If it gets to the conversation about self-defense, when you educate them that government doesn't give rights, government can help you protect your rights. Government can, you know, codify what those rights are, but government can't grant those rights. When you give them that basic understanding, and then they, especially if they live in a rough neighborhood, you give them the understanding that the government can't tell you that you don't have the right to defend yourself.
Do most people in the hood have a solid understanding of what their gun rights are? Are they totally ignorant, or is there some mixed understanding? What do you see out there, Maj?
Overall, the feeling is you should have the means to defend yourself. However, we've been conditioned in urban America to believe that we're supposed to do what the government say, as opposed to our voices, the republic.
And the government of Philadelphia makes it hard for people to exercise it.
Right.
I think that there's a misperception because Pennsylvania is a pro-gun state, and that Philadelphia would be the same way because it's in the state. Well, it's not. And the way the Philadelphia police and justice mechanisms treat gun ownership, it's trashing their rights.
Right.
And there have not been many successful attempts at challenging those illegal practices. So it's no wonder that people don't understand their rights.
Right. And it starts not even just at that. When it's law enforcement involved, that means it's already gotten past the point where the people weren't aware. The people weren't educated. There should be no politician that feels comfortable pushing an agenda or a bill like this. The reason why they're comfortable is because the constituency has been tricked. And that starts at home and school. That's all a miseducation conversation. That's a conversation about changing the paradigm. And that's why we've been effective, because we can explain, yo, you've been lied to on purpose, you know? And translating that lesson to somebody is way bigger as a first step, is way bigger than the actual gun. You know what I mean? When you tell somebody you have a natural human birthright to defend your life, if need be, with the most effective means available, and currently that most effective means is a firearm, you change that person's mind from that point on.
There's no more effective kind of self-ownership statement than that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You feel me? I and do. So when you get people from a demographic that's been told something else deliberately for generations, and you get them to wake up in that regard, you know, you start changing culture.
Right.
You change culture, you change action.
Dependence.
Change action, you change the politics. Right. And so you get those people that, because all of the politicians are just people. And they know, look, if the vast majority of people are like, absolutely not, then you won't even present it as something, because you'll offend your constituency, you know? And so my job is to make sure that we're educating that demographic. So to answer your question, there's a lot of misinformation or ignorance, but there's a lot of open-mindedness, because so many people know that they don't know, you know?
Okay.
And then when they are aware, they start asking these gangs the questions, you know? And then some people that have been affected negatively by the trauma around the ignorance of a firearm, they're moving off of that trauma, which is why they go.
Is that something, you know, because we keep saying that you're in the hood. I mean, you know, I think this is probably true for many or most of these big cities with big murder problems. The central business districts are free from this kind of crime. It's in North Philly, it's in West Philly, it's in South Philly. And do those people have a different perspective on this? Because they're on the front lines. They're more likely to actually sort of see the trauma related to this kind of crime, to see a body on the street, much more than most Americans would have the opportunity to.
Right, and that trauma is still coming from a place of ignorance. That means an ignorant person that does not understand the responsible nature that goes along with firearms ownership did something ignorant with a firearm. Then that person is either connected to in some way to that person that was died, and then they move off of the trauma. So the next logical approach there would be, you know, you would think would be to say, man, you know, this, never mind the person, this gun. If the person, the bad guy, didn't have the gun, then my friend or loved one would still be alive. And I can understand that logic or that line of logic. Mm-hmm. The problem is that person, regardless of if the gun is lawful or not, is still that person, you know. With that being the case, if that person was more educated around the responsibilities of firearms ownership and the general culture, then more than likely that trauma wouldn't have even happened. As well as the other side of it is, even if that person was hell-bent on being a bad evildoer per se, if the person that is now dead would have had the means to defend his or herself, they would still be here. Mm-hmm. You know, so presenting it in those terms as opposed to, yeah, something has to be done about guns. There is something being done about guns. It's educating people to be responsible and on point. You know, it's just a plot twist to get people outside of some of the victim-based mentality that has been shoved in their face for however long.
I always thought that the hood had a ripe audience for a libertarian message because of it being in the front lines of the drug war.
Right.
And when I look at those dots on the map, the homicides, a lot of those corners are drug corners. And I'm wondering, are you a fan of The Wire? And do you think the drug war has made it fertile ground for libertarianism?
Well, the drug war is definitely that. As well as when you look at places like Portugal and what happened since they legalized all drugs, mm-hmm. violent crime went down dramatically. The black market, quote unquote black market, I like to say the white market just to make people think of it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? That pretty much dried up overnight. You know what I'm saying? And so it's like, people should have the right to do whatever they want. If you want to shoot heroin, cool, do it. Be able to afford your habit.
Right.
Don't expect us to pay for it.
The only reason they can't afford it, if anybody doesn't know, is because it's illegal. It would be $20 a week max.
Right.
To have more heroin than you could kill yourself with at market price.
Right.
That's without the prohibition premium. Sorry for the tangent.
No, it's all right. All of these things are perspectives that, you know, even if you're a dope fiend, if you like, look, I have the right to do this and I want to. That's a freedom conversation. If you're not a dope fiend and if, you know somebody's like, look, they want to take their dope over there, they're not interacting with my thing. There is fertile ground for the hood, as outside of the fact that the disproportionate amount of people, you know, melanated beings that are attacked on because of the drug war is another reason why, you know, urban America is ripe for the conversation about liberty and libertarian ideology. Because we like, look, it's freedom. You do whatever you want as long as it's not affecting somebody else's physical body or their personal property. The hood is in alignment with that. The problem is we haven't had hood representatives translating that to that same demographic. That's where we come in at. So that's why we get in this. Again, like you said, that's why you're getting people from urban America, rural America, suburban America hitting you up saying, yo, I like this guy, because the conversation is about freedom. I don't have to agree with what the person's doing. I just have to respect their right to do it. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know what I mean?
I do. Maj, are you doing active firearm familiarization classes for people that are heeding the message of Black Guns Matter and they want to get into the world of guns in a good way, but they didn't have an uncle who taught them or anything like that?
Yeah, so we do that part too. So we have, you know, classes as well as around the nation. As well as we'll be opening up a shop soon so people can come get some of the basics. You know, I thought about it. That's a lot of work. I don't know if my schedule will allow me to do it, but I'm pretty sure somebody on my team could probably do it. But as far as like, you know, like we got a gang of cert pistols. And if you're talking about proper handling and manipulation, you don't even need like active firearms to do that part as far as teaching that portion of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? And then we also, but we do that as well as take people over to the range and things of that nature. So it's a holistic, all-encompassing scenario. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Is there a particular type of firearm that you would recommend to first-time urban gun owners?
Handgun or rifle?
Well, that's my question to you. What would you recommend? Which one over the other? Let's say I had a few hundred dollars, not a crazy amount of money that I was willing to spend on it.
If it's a few hundred bucks and if it's your first time, start with handgun, because you're going to go in a rifle. But rifles are a little more expensive generally than handguns. But as far as like handguns, I mean, if I had to say practical that fits in a good Venn diagram of everything, I would say Glock 19 or Glock 17. Glock 19 more than likely.
You know, that's a solid recommendation, and if you even wanted to save some more money, Glocks are really hard to make. They're really hard to damage. They're a robust gun. So you could actually make a deal and go get a used one.
Right.
Discount.
You could get a used joint. You might have to, you know, change out some springs or something. But for the most part, Glocks are super reliable.
I was checking out your social media, and I noticed this million-dollar challenge I'm seeing out there. Can you tell people what that's about?
Yeah, so all of our classes over the last few years have been crowdsourced. We've raised the money that we've raised. We've done that in a space where we were able to pay it forward to people. So let's say if you said, hey, I'm going to donate $100 to what Maj is doing, and we go to Chicago. We're able to give these classes where everyone can come in for free and learn for free because other people have paid it forward. That's not leaning on a government, and it's supporting, you know, a basic freedom, as well as we removing the financial barrier to entry to learn for people that may not have it off top. You know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
So that's really the thing. So a few weeks ago, we hit our $200,000 goal. We did that. We would, you know, we were doing the classes as we were moving forward. So we fundraised and did the class, We did it like that. We hit 200,000, and then we, you know, I was like, man, we, you know, a lot of people was like, man, you didn't come to our town yet. So I said, you know, I put a poll up on social media. I asked, do you think that we should stop here, or do should we raise it to like $1 million? Over 90% of people voted and said, let's raise it to $1 million. And that's what we did. So right now, anybody that's listening, you know, when you guys get a chance to check this out, if you agree with some of the things that we're saying, and if you want to pay that forward, if you just happen to be rich and you got a couple of, you know, like $800,000 to $800,000 around, if you want to go to our work, you know, that's dope. But at the same time, man, like, you know, in essence, even if it's only $5, you know, helping and us working together, dude, that's philanthropy. That's charity. That's positive.
I just want to make sure everybody knows, so there's no confusion. This is not, he's not talking about here a political contribution.
Correct.
This is a contribution for the educational message and bringing that message of gun rights to other Americans.
Correct.
And
correct.
Okay. Is Donald Trump a pro-gun president?
So far, no. He has not. You know, and I've heard the theories of, you know, the 4D chess, and all of his actions so far over the last few years have been very anti-gun.
I was shocked by the bump stock ban, what he did there. You know, I think that when he got elected, I mean, Hillary would have been perhaps the worst anti-gun president in history. So there's a sigh of relief when he gets elected. But what has he done for us lately?
Right. And so having that conversation and being objective enough to even say that doesn't mean you hate Donald Trump or hate anybody. It just means, no, your actions have been your actions. And you have not been, even with the support of the NRA, you have been a very anti-gun president. Now, maybe that'll change. Maybe he was doing that until 2020, where he had more time before and so on. Maybe he was saving that for later. Maybe. Hopefully so. But as it stands right now, no. Not only was he pushing the bump stock ban, but he also, you know, has been sniffing around silences, saying he doesn't like them and so forth and so on. You know, which is, it's not, that's not even a firearm. That's a tool to muffle the sound.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, he's not a pro-gun president.
This is a truth. If you are elected and seated on the city council, what legislative proposals and enactments and changes will you try to get through? What's your legislative priorities going to be?
Yeah, so one of those big things is trying to implement and working with the schools to get civics being more prominent back in the lesson plan and the curriculum. I think that some of the reasons why we're in some of these spaces where there's so much crime and ignorance is because people aren't having an understanding in the public school level.
Oh my God, you are so right. It's
you know what I'm saying?
How right you are, my man. If people are educated about their rights, they're much more likely to act to protect them.
Correct. You know what I mean? You have equity built up in those rights now. You know what I'm saying? And so it's like, that's one of the biggest things to me. Like, before we even have the conversation about a firearm or safety or any of that, how can we show how important it is for people to understand who their local politicians are? You know what I mean? These are the things that, you know, that play out in a very practical way. So those are one of the biggest things. The other is, you know, the decriminalization of cannabis. You know, I think that's a big thing, because then that ties more back into the concept of freedom. I mean, like, listen, we all know that the whole weed is a gateway drug is a myth. We already know that. That's been debunked a thousand bajillion times.
It's a lie used by...
It's a straight-up lie.
Yes.
So it's like, if we can get people to have that understanding that freedom is freedom, you know, and the choice to smoke weed, if we isolated it to weed, is a personal choice that, okay, cool. People shouldn't be going to jail for that. So that's another thing. Everything that I talk about for my entire campaign, as well as my run at city council, is about freedom. That's it. It's about freedom. Giving Philadelphians more freedoms back to their actual life.
Mm-hmm. What's the current state of the law in Pennsylvania about weed?
It's legal up to a certain amount, which isn't technically legal. That's not freedom. That's still the government saying if you smoke this, too much of this, we can tell you to go to jail. All of that is an infringement. That's an infringement on my right. Like, how big of a contradiction is that? So I can smoke, as a person that smokes cigars, I smoke cigars. Cigars are cancer. So I can smoke this that we show hundreds of thousands, if not up towards the 500,000 deaths from cancer, from smoking annually. But there's not the same level of deaths or discomfort in health around cannabis, but this one will send you to jail and this one doesn't. Honestly, it's a contradiction.
Even if there was, it's your life, you know, Maj?
Right. It's your choice. It's your choice.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Maj. Anything we missed that you want said?
Everybody, man, please, for the city council run, we're going to need as much energy and resources as possible. MajForPhilly.com, MajForPhilly, MajForPhilly.com. Please donate, volunteer if you're in the Philadelphia area. And again, we run both of these fundraising campaigns at the same time. If we can get $1 million to get the city council seat, that's great. And as well as if we can get $1 million to give away for the Black Guns Matter classes, that's dope too. So for that, GoFundMe.com/Black Guns Matter. And the city council campaign, again, which is a separate campaign, MajForPhilly.com. Please, if you've shared or agreed with some of the things that we talked about today, please hit us up. We would love your support.
And I will clarify, just so there's no misunderstandings, we are a nonprofit. We do not endorse any candidate for office. That includes Maj Ture. That includes any candidate for any office. And any candidate for city council in Philadelphia is welcome to come on The Uprising and talk about their vision, especially for gun policy and Second Amendment rights in the city of brotherly love. Maj, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you, my brother.
Cheers. I appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Peace.
Well, I enjoyed that. I hope you did, too. And maybe we'll see some more interesting interviews on The Uprising. Here's one that was a pleasant surprise we were able to squeeze in. For a very brief interlude. On his vacation
week. Emphasis on brief.
On a week where you are about to go and further do damage to the metric system's inroads in the United States of America. I won't get in more specific than that. Tim Donner, former co-host of the Uprising podcast, for a Tom Steyer for President update. Tim, welcome back to the Uprising.
Is it just that the Biden stuff has gotten so stale that there's nothing new? He's a buffoon. He bumbled. He stumbled. He made multiple ridiculous errors in the well,
that's true every week that he's been alive, right? I mean, is there a week where that hasn't been true for Lunch Bucket Joe?
I think, though, in this case, before we get on to the subject at hand, Star, I want to play you a quickie. A quickie.
Where do you hide these clips? And you got like a secret pocket somewhere over there?
It's a quickie of Biden with 10 stumbles and bumbles in a single speech. So here it is.
All right.
Donald Trump and the demagogues around the world are leaning into these forces over fascism and autocracy. We believe in free speech. That's why I'll end the gag rule, the global gag rule that prevents money. We have to be honest about, we've neglected the basics by strengthening. Folks,
by strengthening.
We're virtually energy independent. He has, I don't know how to say it, in partnerships built on coercion, to take on non-traditional threats like weaponized corruption. They'll reduce emissions.
I'm sorry. I hate to pick on the guy.
When was that from?
That was an utter embarrassment.
That's from the past week?
Earlier this week.
Earlier this week.
I mean, yeah. How many times did he get it? By strengthening, he can't come up with the word. It's like he's just kind of winging it. You know, these speeches are written, but it's like he's winging it.
Oh, no, he is winging it. That's how he's gotten. Tim, this was a guy. who got the who won the lottery when Barack Obama thought he'll give me the veil of kind of respectability or staidness. I mean, otherwise we would never. I mean, it's a joke of a conversation. Yeah. This is a person who,
as president of the United States, absolutely.
I mean, he never got any traction at all. What's the most he got? Turn your statistical brain on for a second. What were his previous vote totals?
Well, first of all, he never even made it to the first contest in 1988 because he had to pull out when they discovered that he had plagiarized
a
speech from the British, British labor leader. But he had to pull out, no matter how unjust that might have been.
There were a lot of Delawareans disappointed when that happened.
Bitterly.
Go ahead.
Bitterly disappointed.
He had to
try to keep a straight face.
There was at least one poll conducted somewhere during the course of a previous candidacy, though, right?
Well, so then he runs again in 2008 against Obama and fails to crest 1% in the Iowa caucus. And pulls out after the first contest.
So it was a small but dedicated group of supporters that
emphasis on the former rather than the latter. Now the thing is, the guy has never faced a national electorate. He got elected in Delaware, which is, let's just say, it's an insular state.
Now, he's been very successful in the first state, hasn't he, in terms of his electoral
all he's ever really
successes?
Done, all he's really done is won one election, the first one.
And then, of course,
getting elected,
the sympathy vote.
And but multiples.
No, well, you can't deny that whole thing. I mean, his family was decimated by a car crash.
Yes,
it seemed untoward to kind of challenge him.
I would say you're right, except that it happened so early. That, remember, he wasn't even up for re-election for about another 6 years. So, clearly the sympathy, but he's been re-elected.
The power of incumbency takes over. And,
precisely. And in Delaware, if you're the Democrat and you're the guy that's been selected by the party machinery,
there you go.
You're in the cotton. But every time he went to a national forum, he just stumbled. Right.
Well, they don't have
terribly.
The banking interests so powerful. Yeah. You know, you give them what you want,
so
you get
go.
What you need.
But much more interesting is the entrance of Tom Steyer.
Go ahead. Tom Steyer is he's a farm worker, right? That's how he he's a socialist, right?
Yeah,
he's like
well, you're half right.
Uh-huh.
He's not a farmer, nor does he play one on TV. He is at least posturing to be a socialist, but here's the whole
because he came up through the coal mines, right?
Yes, that's right, Scott. You made your point. I mean, this guy, he flies under the radar, mostly because of George Soros, because George Soros...
Do quickly, if you would, just a 20-second thumbnail sketch of who this guy is for people who don't know.
He's a venture capitalist from California.
A billionaire?
He is a billionaire several times over. He's one of the richest men in America, and he got there through investments in the coal industry.
Mm-hmm.
And yet now he is posturing himself as a radical environmentalist. It's the most classic case of white liberal guilt, Scott, that I've ever witnessed. I've been looking for a long time for the opening, the opportunity to talk about Tom Steyer because he flies under the radar. This guy has poured tens of millions of dollars into leftist causes, extreme leftist causes, radical environmental causes for years. He was behind the impeachment of Trump movement. He poured millions into ads in the 2018 midterms. Okay, now he's off of impeachment and he's into some kind of goo-goo agenda that, you know, sounds really good to the left wing of the Democratic Party. But the guy is a case study in hypocrisy.
You have to stop just for a second there and let me ask you, have you seen the Marianne Williamson racial apology video?
Every time I hear Marianne Williamson, space out into another.
Well, then you definitely haven't because if you think that Tom Steyer.
So you're thinking that maybe Steyer Williamson would be a good ticket.
I think she's too woke to accept him. Go ahead and play candidate Williamson, please.
I'm going to ask the white Americans in the room to please repeat after me. On behalf of myself and on behalf of my country, to you and all African Americans.
You can participate, Tim, as well.
Oh, okay.
If you feel, only if you feel it. Nation's okay.
History, I'm starting to feel it, Scott. It's starting to be overcome by it.
In honor of your ancestors and spirit. On behalf of your children. Please hear this from my heart.
This is the unabridged version.
Please forgive us. With this prayer, I acknowledge the depth of the evils that have been perpetrated against black people in America.
Can you imagine?
What god is she praying to, by the way?
Uh-huh.
Do we know?
A Gaia.
From slavery to lynchings to white supremacist laws.
Do we have to play the whole thing?
No, we don't.
Okay.
We don't.
Gong.
There's a lot
gong.
To. There's a lot to apologize
I can't take
for,
anymore.
Tim. To be sure, you, Tim, have much to apologize for being
personally,
so
yes.
very white.
Yeah, I
that's
really
the thing.
Am. I am hopelessly Caucasian.
That means you have a lot. Here's the question I asked when I saw
too.
That video: does Barack Obama need to apologize to himself
for his white?
He's biracial.
He's biracial. Sign, yeah. So he could issue a tepid apology. See, instead of a full apology, it'd be like a half apology.
Or does he have to at all? Yeah. It's like when a mixed marriage where one's a Republican and one's a Democrat and they just decide to stay home on election day to
sure.
save themselves the trouble. I wonder. But I just thought it was, I mean, can you imagine? First of all, the idea that, let's say it were actually true, okay, that it were somehow real guilt. Like, that would make it better, right? That's an abomination. That is...
So
how the hell does this woman...
Okay, so now I see where the intersection is between Tom Steyer and Marianne Williamson. It's white liberal guilt. I see
yes.
the point you're making now.
Yes.
And, I mean, it is on parade. How about Beto O'Rourke with his
Come
white
on.
Liberal guilt and Robert Francis and his... fawning apologies for his white privilege and his maleness. It's a pathetic show. It's kind of makes you cringe and looking at these people trying to renounce everything that they are, where they've come from, their upbringing, their culture. It's as if it all suddenly should just be just circle the drain and go right down.
It's true. The thing is, you can't have it both ways. You can't celebrate this victimhood culture and the cultural identity wars and then be a white guy. Like, if you really do believe heartfeltly what Beto says that he believes, then he would have to say, for instance, well, I think Stacey Abrams should have my votes, my money, my support, my whatever, right? Because I'm so far... advantaged. Like, put your money where your mouth is. There's a great clip of Ben Shapiro somewhere on YouTube. I think he's at Dartmouth or somewhere. And somebody like recognizing one of the students is recognizing their privilege, you know, before the like a Q&A session. He's like, just leave. Give your spot to some disadvantaged person. You just said it. Walk out the door. You have all the power, but you don't do that.
No.
Anyway. All right,
good,
so let me
good for me, but not for thee.
Right. All right. So let me ask you. You know, we had the death of a man who was a class act. I think, no matter what you thought of his politics, who was the first billionaire to run for president, Mr. H. Ross Perot.
Yes.
Last week. Now we got Steyer coming in. Is the billions? You know, does that mean a lot in the race? Is it? You know, he's going to put a ton of dough behind it, so he's automatically a power figure. Give us the analysis.
Well, let's put it this way: he is committed to spending upwards of $100 million on the race, which is more than the combined totals of the top five.
Okay.
In terms of what they've raised to date, and that is Biden and Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren and. Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, the only ones that have a chance. I don't think Buttigieg really has a chance.
Can we say Buttigieg here on the Uprising? And you know
sorry.
It. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. May I have another? So Steyer will pour in the money. But, you know, we've seen from President Jeb Bush and President John Conley in the past where they pour in massive amounts of money and go nowhere. Biden's problem has never been that he can't raise money. It's that he can't deliver anything. That people see him as a classic example of the Peter principle. Steyer wants to play politics, you know, and he wants to assuage his white liberal guilt by becoming, let's put it down to its basics, Scott. He is dedicating his life to stopping people from making money exactly the way that he did.
Well, he's got a guilty conscience. Let me ask you a question as a closeout. Back to school time. Where's Tom Steyer sitting in the polls?
He's probably going to be in the top six or seven, if only by default, because
of
he's
the
got so much, such a bankroll.
But not a true contender, though.
I don't think so. Tom Steyer, he's a patrician. Even the New York Times said he was kind of a stiff, to be honest with you. Even the New York Times. I don't see him going far, but because of his money and because people don't want to, you know, other Democrats in the race don't want to piss him off because the guy bankrolls so many of the things. He believes in the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, the whole kit and caboodle across the board, radical
fully
leftist
woke.
Agenda. Fully woke. Fully woke for an old, privileged white man. Just what we needed in the race, another old, privileged white man
to tell us how horrible
things are for old
privileged white men are and how difficult they make it for everyone else
to self-renounce. That's the hidden catchphrase of the Democratic primary.
Well, thanks so much, Tim. You continue to enjoy your summer privileges, and everyone else can enjoy theirs as well. As soon as they like, comment, and subscribe, tell a friend. Download and listen to The Rabbit Hole, Politics and Prose by Liberty Nation's Mark Angelides. You'll dig it. It's a good podcast. Bye. Thank you.